All right, listeners, ready for another deep dive? Today, we're taking a close look at a case that's pretty much a cornerstone in corporate law. Ferris v. Glenn Alden Corporation.
Yeah, this one's a classic. You know, it's amazing how a case from 1958 can still feel so relevant today.
Absolutely. It really shows how tricky mergers and acquisitions can be.
Yeah, it's not always a simple A plus B equals C situation. Sometimes things get a little more complicated.
Right. And in Ferris, we see what happens when a shareholder feels like a deal is actually a merger in disguise and decides to fight back.
It really highlights the tension between what's legal on paper and the actual economic impact. You know, what's really going on.
Okay, so let's set the scene.
Yeah.
It's 1958 in Pennsylvania. Glenn Alden's a coal mining company, and they're having some financial troubles.
And then along comes List Industries. This holding company has its fingers in all sorts of pies, a much more diverse portfolio.
And they already own a good chunk of Glenn Alden stock, something like 38.5%. They even have a few people on the board.
Yeah, they're definitely looking to flex their muscles a bit.
So they come up with this reorganization agreement. On the surface, it looks like a typical asset purchase. Glenn Alden takes on all of List's assets and liabilities, issues new stock to List's shareholders, even changes its name to List Alden.
This would be pretty standard, right? But here's the catch as part of this deal. List Industries dissolves itself.
That's a big red flag.
It is. Suddenly it feels like something else is going on. Maybe this isn't just a simple acquisition.
Exactly. And this is where Mr. Ferris, our main player, comes in. He's a Glenn Alden shareholder, and he's not buying this reorganization at all.
He smells a rat, right?
Big time. He sees this as a sneaky way to push through a merger without going through the usual process, maybe even a way to sidestep shareholder rights. So he decides to take a stand.
This is where the whole concept of a de facto merger comes into play. You know, even if a deal doesn't technically tick all the boxes for a traditional merger, if it looks and acts like one, well, the court's going to look beyond the labels.
They're going to consider the substance over the form.
Exactly. What's the real impact here?
So the initial court actually sided with Mr. Ferris. They issued an injunction to stop the deal. But of course, Glenn Alden appealed.
They argued it was just a regular acquisition, nothing to see here.
But then it went up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And their decision, well, let's just say it made some serious waves.
It became a landmark case that we're still talking about today. This case isn't just about some companies in Pennsylvania. It's about the power dynamics between shareholders and corporations. And sometimes the courts need to step in to make sure things are fair.
So let's break down the court's reasoning. What were some of the key points they made in their decision?
Well, first they focused on what they called the fundamental change to Glenn Alden. Remember, they started as a coal mining company, and suddenly they're this mishmash of different businesses.
Yeah, talk about an identity crisis.
Right. This wasn't what the original Glenn Alden shareholders signed up for. They invested in a coal company, not a conglomerate.
It totally changed the nature of their investment.
Yeah.
So it's not just about adding a new product line or something. It's a complete transformation.
Exactly. And the second thing the court pointed out was the shift in control. Once List Industries dissolved, their directors took over the new List Alden. The original Glenn Alden shareholders basically lost their voice.
It's like their company got hijacked.
That's a good way to put it. And then there's the financial side of things. Remember, Mr. Ferris saw the value of his shares plummet from $38 per share down to $21.
Ouch. That's not just some abstract number. That's a real loss.
The court really drove home this point about substance over form. They were saying, we see what you're doing here. You can call it a reorganization, but it walks and talks like a merger. So we're treating it as such.
The court really dug into the legal details, too. They specifically looked at the 1957 amendments to the Pennsylvania Business Corporation Law.
And they said those changes didn't erase a shareholder's right to dissent in these kinds of situations.
So it's like they were sending a message. You can't use legal loopholes to silence shareholders or force them into something they didn't agree to.
Exactly. And out of this case came the de facto merger test, a three-prong test to determine if a deal should be considered a merger, even if it's dressed up as something else.
And they used Mr. Ferris's situation as the prime example.
And this test has had a lasting impact. It's influenced courts in other states, too.
It's a message to corporations. You can't just slap a fancy label on something and expect to get away with it. Courts are going to look at the reality of the situation and protect shareholder rights.
Exactly. And to really hammer this point home, Justice Cohen, who wrote the majority opinion, he used some strong language. He basically said, when a corporation combines in a way that completely changes its identity and the relationship between the company and its shareholders, well, those shareholders who don't want to be part of this new entity, They have the right to opt out and get fair value for their shares.
It's all about protecting shareholder autonomy, their right to choose.
Right. Welcome back to our deep dive on Ferris v. Glenn Alden. You know, we were just talking about how this case still has a big impact on corporate law today.
Yeah, and you brought up a really interesting point about how it applies to things like SPACs and those big tech acquisitions. Mm-hmm. But before we get into all that, can we back up a sec and really break down that de facto merger test that the court came up with?
Oh, absolutely. That's a key concept. Mm-hmm. It helps us analyze all these complex situations.
So refresh my memory. What are the factors again?
All right, so the first one asks, does this deal completely change what the acquiring company is all about? Remember Glenn Alden? They went from being a coal mining company to this, like, diversified holding company practically overnight.
Right. Their whole identity went through a major shift.
Exactly. So it's more than just, you know, adding a new product or going after a similar market. It has to be a real game changer, something that transforms the essence of the business.
Got it. Okay, so what about the second factor?
Well, that one looks at whether the deal shifts control of the acquiring company over to the shareholders of the company that's being acquired. You know, in Ferris, when List Industries dissolved and their directors took over the new List Alden, well, that was a pretty clear sign of a power shift.
Right, the original Glenn Alden shareholders basically lost all their say.
Exactly. So it's all about who's really in charge after the deal goes through. Does the acquiring company still even resemble the company that the original shareholders invested in?
Right. It's like you think you're buying stock in one company and then bam, it turns into something totally different.
That's it. And then the third factor that the court looks at is whether the shareholders of the acquiring company basically end up as shareholders of a completely different corporation.
So it's kind of like that bait and switch thing. You think you're investing in one thing, but then it morphs into something else entirely.
Exactly. So if the court sees all three of these factors at play, they're pretty much going to say, nope, this is a de facto merger no matter what you call it.
It's a powerful tool for the courts to look beyond all the legal jargon and really get to the bottom of what's happening to the shareholders.
Exactly. And it's not just about protecting shareholders from investments they didn't sign up for. It's also about making sure they get their appraisal rights if a court decides that a de facto merger actually happened.
You're talking about the right of dissenting shareholders to get the fair market value for their shares if they don't agree with a merger right.
That's right. Those rights are usually pretty clear in a typical statutory merger. But sometimes companies try to use this de facto merger structure to avoid those obligations, hoping that the shareholders won't notice or won't do anything about it.
Which is why cases like Ferris are so important. They expose those tactics and help shareholders understand what they can do.
And let's not forget about the impact that Ferris had on the law itself. After the decision, a lot of states, including Pennsylvania, updated their corporate laws to deal with de facto mergers. Some of them specifically included the doctrine in their laws, while others clarified the language around shareholder rights.
So Ferris wasn't just a win for Mr. Ferris. It actually pushed for greater transparency and accountability in the world of M&A.
Exactly. It made lawmakers realize that there was room for abuse and that they needed to do more to protect shareholder rights.
Okay, so now that we have a good understanding of the de facto merger doctrine, I'm really curious to see how it all plays out in today's corporate world. You mentioned SPACs earlier. What are your thoughts on how Ferris applies to those deals?
Ah, SPACs, those special purpose acquisition companies, they've become so popular lately. It's a really interesting area where the principles from Ferris are being debated and tested right now.
For those of us who might not be familiar with them, can you give us a quick rundown of how SPACs work?
Sure. So imagine you have a company, we'll call it a blank check company.
Yeah.
This company goes public with the sole purpose of buying another company. That's basically what a SPAC is. They raise money through an IPO and they promise investors that they'll find a promising target company to merge with within a certain time frame, usually about 2 years.
So it's kind of like a reverse merger where the private company goes public by merging with this SPAC that's already listed.
Exactly. And that's where the whole de facto merger doctrine comes in. Technically, it's the SPAC that's acquiring the private company. But a lot of times it feels like it's the other way around. It's like the private company is taking over, using the SPAC's resources to basically go public through the back door.
I see what you're saying. Could the SPAC shareholders argue that they're being forced into investing in something totally different from what they originally thought, especially if the target company is in a completely different industry?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what courts are trying to figure out right now.
Yeah.
Some people say that the way SPACs are structured with that uncertainty about the target company, that's enough transparency for investors to make informed decisions.
So basically, they're saying, hey, if you buy into a SPAC, you're buying into the unknown. Don't come crying later if you don't like what you end up with.
Right. But then there are others who say that the de facto merger doctrine should still apply. They argue that it's about protecting shareholders from being misled or pushed into investments that drastically change what they own.
So there's no easy answer. It sounds like applying Ferris to the world of SPACs is still a bit of a gray area legally, with different interpretations and outcomes depending on the specifics of the deal.
You got it. And that's why understanding Ferris v. Glenn Alden is still so important. It gives us this framework for analyzing these new and constantly evolving types of transactions. It makes us ask those important questions. Are shareholders being treated fairly? Are their rights being respected?
It reminds us that legal principles, even ones from decades ago, can be surprisingly adaptable and relevant to the way businesses operate today.
Absolutely. And, you know, speaking of modern business practices, you also mentioned those tech giants that are scooping up startups left and right.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think the de facto merger doctrine might apply in those situations?
All right, welcome back for the final part of our deep dive into Ferris v. Glenn Alden. So far, we've really gone deep on the majority opinion that de facto merger doctrine and, you know, how this case from 1958 is still making waves in deals happening today, like with those SPACs in the tech world.
Yeah, it really shows how a case from way back then can still be so relevant today.
Well, you know, there's one important part of Ferris we haven't talked about yet, the dissenting opinion.
Oh, right. Even though the majority opinion, like, set this huge precedent, there was another side to the story, a different perspective.
Exactly. And sometimes those dissenting opinions, they have some real gems in them. You know, they challenge us to think differently, and they give us a more complete picture of the legal issues.
Okay, so let's hear what the dissenting judges had to say about Ferris. What were their main disagreements?
Well, in this case, the dissent was written by Justice Bell. He really disagreed with the majority's idea that this deal between Glenn Alden and List Industries was a de facto merger. His argument was all about what the lawmakers intended and, you know, sticking to the actual wording of the Pennsylvania Business Corporation law.
So he thought the court was overstepping its bounds, like trying to rewrite the law to fit their interpretation of this particular deal. Exactly. Justice Bell said that the law already clearly defined what a merger was in those 1957 amendments to the Business Corporation law, and this reorganization agreement, well, it just didn't fit the bill. He pointed out that the law lays out specific steps for a merger, you know, including those shareholder appraisal rights.
So basically, if a deal doesn't follow those steps by the book, then it's not a merger, no matter what it looks like in practice.
That's right. He was warning against the court creating this whole new category of de facto merger. He said it would just cause confusion and maybe even get in the way of legitimate business deals.
So he's basically saying stick to the script. If lawmakers wanted de facto mergers in the law, they would have put it in there plain and simple.
Exactly. He felt like the majority was pushing their own agenda instead of just following the law.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was worried that this decision would open the floodgates for lawsuits with shareholders challenging all kinds of deals that weren't technically mergers, but, you know, had similar results.
So he's all about a strict, literal interpretation of the law, keeping things predictable for businesses.
Makes sense. Yeah, that's a valid point. Businesses need to know what the rules are. So too much uncertainty can stifle innovation and hold back economic growth.
And his point about, you know, potentially making companies less flexible, that's important too.
Yeah.
Maybe companies would be afraid to make complex deals, even if those deals could be good for shareholders if they're always worried about facing these de facto merger challenges.
Exactly. It all comes down to that classic debate, judicial activism versus judicial restraint. Should courts interpret laws broadly to address what they see as unfair or to protect individual rights? Or should they stick closely to the written law and leave policy changes to the lawmakers?
And we see this debate come up all the time in legal disputes, especially in corporate law, where the rules are so complex and the business world is changing so fast.
Absolutely. But, you know, even though Justice Bell dissented, his arguments weren't just ignored. They actually contributed to a bigger conversation in the legal world about the limits of the de facto merger doctrine. Dissenting opinions can often be really influential in shaping legal thought.
So even though his dissent didn't change the outcome in Ferris, it may have influenced later cases or even changes to the law that aim to clarify this whole area.
Exactly. It reminds us that legal precedents, they aren't set in stone. They're part of this ongoing conversation. Courts, lawmakers, legal scholars, everyone's trying to figure out these complex issues and keep up with a changing world.
It's a good reminder that we should always be thinking critically, looking at things from different angles, and constantly learning and refining our understanding of the law.
Well said. And that's why deep dives like this are so valuable. You know, we look at the majority opinion, we analyze the dissenting opinion, we talk about the real-world implications. It all helps us understand this fascinating area of corporate law so much better.
Absolutely. I hope our listeners, whether they're lawyers, law students, or just anyone interested in business and law, that they walk away with a deeper understanding of this landmark case and how it continues to shape things today.
I hope so, too. Because at the end of the day, Ferris v. Glenn Alden really highlights some timeless principles, the importance of transparency, fairness, and accountability, especially when it comes to shareholders and corporations.
It's a great reminder that legal precedents, even ones from decades ago, can still be relevant and impact how we deal with mergers, acquisitions, and protecting shareholders. So to all our listeners, keep those legal minds sharp, keep asking those tough questions, and we'll catch you on our next deep dive.